Hi, and welcome to the Almanac. I'm your host, Adam Forte, and this week, in lieu of a live guest, we have something a little bit different, again. So this week, I was helping moderate an event that happened at McMaster's Research Park. And so this event is called Researchers Night. It's an annual event where researchers from around the community, McMaster, and apparently France, we have a lot of French connection with this event. They come and they present their research to, you know, a broad audience. And what makes this event kind of cool is that it's always interdisciplinary. This year we had four panelists from very diverse backgrounds. Let me just introduce you to our panelists. So Dr. Lavallier is a research scientist at the National Research Center in France. He's an expert in biophysics, epigenetics, and food science, and teaches in many universities and professional schools. This includes Sorbonne University, Le Cordon Bleu, Basque Culinary Center. He's also responsible for the scientific training of cooking teachers at the national level. So at this event, he actually had a hands-on demo. He, you know, brought some food and he whipped up some cool stuff. So specifically, he showed us how beating egg white can turn it into that meringue type substance, and a couple tips and tricks for doing it quickly and why specifically it worked. It was pretty cool. He told us how to make a 1 minute mousse. Our second panelist, Geneviève Sicotte, looks into the imagery of food in Quebec literature and culture. And most recently, she's been developing a body of creative audiovisual and digital work. It's called Vital Signs. It's being launched in 2020. And she describes it as a type of digital literature. So it's video and it's audio, it's poetry. It's all concerned with how we interact with food, sort of on an emotional level, on a deeper, more literary level. Our third panelist, Dr. Parmjeet Singh from McMaster University, is a mindfulness expert, and he talked about how food contributes to our physical, mental, and emotional well-being, and how, you know, eating mindfully and taking all of these things into account can lead to a healthier, happier life. And finally, we get to Dr. Tina Moffitt. She works on so many cool interdisciplinary projects. On Monday, she was talking about her work on studying the cultural dimensions of food insecurity among immigrants and refugees. So, briefly, household food insecurity is experienced by many immigrants and refugees in Canada. Though culture strongly influences food and eating, little is known about the interaction between culture and immigrant food insecurity. So Dr. Moffitt and her team investigate three pillars of food security: availability, access, and use for immigrants and refugees living in medium-sized Canadian cities, much like Hamilton. And in fact, she went into the community to work with these people and get firsthand experience. She's gained multiple perspectives on the challenges of obtaining and eating nutritious and culturally satisfying food through these interviews. And some of the things that she found is that it's not always a financial barrier that's leading to food insecurity. A lot of it has to do with, you know, sort of feeling lost in the supermarket, so to speak. I talked to her a little bit before the event, and we sort of discussed the feeling of, you know, going on a vacation to somewhere very foreign and having to go grocery shopping and just sort of being bewildered. And that's totally fine when you're, you know, away on vacation. You leave with, I don't know, maybe like a can of nuts and some eggs because you recognize those things. But for immigrant and refugee families, this is what they have to deal with day in and day out. And so making these healthy choices and, you know, being able to cook nutritiously for your family becomes really difficult. And this really does lead to food insecurity. So the way this event was set up was Dr. Savalier had a food demonstration. He whipped up some mousses for us and talked the science of what he calls molecular gastronomy. And then we had 10 to 15 minute presentations from the other three panelists. Afterwards, we went into a question and answer period. So I moderated some audience questions, and then I got a chance to ask my own.
So before I turn the microphone back to the audience, I'd like to be selfish and take my own question. So we will get back to you, so let that simmer and stew with your thoughts for a moment. But I wanted to prepare a question that kind of turned you guys against each other in some way. But as I was thinking about it, I kept coming back to the idea of what is a staple food. So for me as a grad student, staple food is basic things like eggs and bread and, in theory, some sort of vegetable, pizza probably. But maybe could you think about that question in terms of your field and what you've talked to us about tonight? Is there some way that you think of staple food that maybe I wouldn't think of? So I'd like to, if possible, hear from a little bit from everybody, maybe.
So I may go first. Bread. Because, of course, you've seen that in a way I'm speaking about real food, actual food that is experienced on a very basic level, but also food has this signification, like in a symbolic way. I don't like the word symbolic because it takes it away in an abstract level, on an abstract level, and that's not what it means. But it's also laden with signification. And our experience of food is full of beliefs, of history. And when we say bread in the Occidental context, of course, this is a staple, but this is also a food that has biblical history, beliefs. So bread tends to be like a primal food. I would say you say staple, I would say primal, in a way that it can be injected with significations, contents, beliefs, values. And when we share bread, we know that we share love. So food can be love as well. And staple food would be some sort of a love food because it builds communities together more than most of the time. So tomorrow night we're studying bread and literary rituals.
I don't know what means staple food.
What?
Staple food, what is
food?
An animal sauce. Okay. So in that sense, yes, I would say it would be for me.
Nice.
Yeah, just because this is bread. This is liquid bread. So I have a bread effect. And this has a wine, because in France we are proud of wine and bread. So, and if you think about the alcohol in the bread, then you got to look at the beer, which is the perfect mix of alcohol and bread. And it's staple food because you have the nutrients, you have the nice euphoric effect of the alcohol, and you have the calorie, and this is the kind of thing, I mean, if you need just one thing during the day, it's a glass of beer, it's probably perfect.
And you get your phone.
Yeah, and you get your phone, exactly.
Yeah.
Like our own personal dietary staple, or just in general or abstract?
I will accept either.
it's a very interesting question from a personal level, because I guess as an anthropologist, and I teach a class on food and nutrition, and we start from our hominid ancestors, and we move to agricultural revolution, and then we talk about, you know, modern day issues and food insecurity is one of them, culture and food. So I think about the part class, you know, talking about hunter-gatherer ancestors and how the idea of the staple didn't really originate until agriculture, where people started to rely on, you know, one or two crops. And we know we can go around the world and we can say, you know, wheat in Europe and rice in Asia and, there's these grains, right, that we've relied on as humans since about 10,000 years ago with the agricultural revolution. So sometimes when I think of staple, I actually think it's not necessarily a great thing, because what happens is when you get relying on one staple is that the diversity of food that we have as hunter-gatherers, where you'd be, you know, doing a little bit of hunting and you'd be, you know, gathering all different types of foods as the seasons change, we've lost that as agriculturalists. Actually, my own kind of wacky diet things that I do and experimental work is I'm actually trying not to rely on staples, but to really diversify my diet all the time. And think I'm trying to work more with plant-based foods now. So how can I have like this kind of almost this hunter-gatherer type of diet, not necessarily the paleo diet, which I don't advocate, but so for me, staples not necessarily a happy word. Mm-hmm. But if I had to tell you right now, lately I've had a whole thing about oatmeal. And this must be my Scottish heritage. I love oatmeal every morning, and you can put all sorts of different things on it. So that would be my current staple.
That's an interesting point with it not necessarily being a good thing. Certainly when you've commercialized a lot of this agriculture stuff, I guess you end up in situations like in America where you have corn.
Corn, yeah, exactly.
And so you got to put it somewhere. You put it in all your foods. Absolutely. You put it in your gas. You put it wherever you can.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Do you have a staple you could share?
Beans, I think... So I think of food in two ways. One, the tangible food. And we do, because I come from India, so we have a staple food, which to me is a situational, which means that it has a cultural context. It is dependent upon what kind of agriculture produce was produced, and people engaged in that kind of process, and then they actually survive through that or thrive through that. So that became staple. So for example, in our Indian culture, we have called, I will speak in language, and then I will translate it, dal roti, which means lentils and bread. And trustingly, bread is universal because I think that has been a kind of one of the maybe variable but a kind of a common source of carbohydrates over the period of ever since human evolution passed through various stages. And then there's another staple, this which is equally, if not more important, is the kind of thought process I engage in, the emotional stuff I consume, and the cultural context of that stuff happening. And to me, those intersect. You know, for example, I give you, if you're angry and you eat your staple food, you will notice that your staple food doesn't sit well in your stomach because of the emotional context. Or if you are sitting with the family members, 9, 10 family members, you tend to overeat your staple food. So it actually has various meanings, but then I always wonder about this intersection and interaction of the intangible food and the tangible food, and how they define my day-to-day life.
Okay.
I tend to think that sometimes I can eat bad food, and I can be out of it within a few days, but if I start thinking bad thoughts, they linger quite a bit.
Right.
And to me, the latter part is actually a lot more harmful over the period of time. And this is where Dr. Lavelle was talking about. The long-term impact of invisible consumption is actually a lot more harmful and economically taxing than the food itself. Eating a burger has a short-term bad effect if you eat here and there, but having an invisible stuff can, in fact, really mess you up. And the society, of course.
Right. Thank you very much. I feel like we can maybe all turn that staple food question on yourselves and maybe turn that into the mindfulness that maybe we're looking for. So before I hand it back to the audience, I will give to our next moderator. So you might have noticed I said I was a co-moderator. That's because I wasn't the only one. Our other moderator was Hélène Caron from The French Toast on CFMU on Mondays at 4 p.m. The next bit of audio you're going to hear is Hélène.
Evaluation. I want to ask a question, maybe not so much directly about food, but rather about your own experience as researchers. So in your careers, I'm sure you've had to face a number of challenges. Food typically has not been on top of the list in terms of academics, research priorities, mostly because food has been associated with the body more. It's not necessarily an intellectual pursuit. If this has been one of your challenges, how have you addressed it? Or maybe you've had other challenges in your careers that you've had to address or you're still addressing. How are you moving forward with that?
This is very good.
Not this place where it doesn't have.
This is a very good question. In fact, that's all the issue about molecular gastronomy, which is a new science. Why a new science? If you think about food science, you always have scientists, science history, who somehow get interested by food. And but it was kind of side subject, like Lavoisier in chemistry. Some of his work was about food, but just some. And you think about more recent research, you have lots of studies about food, but mainly about food process, which means mainly for industry and mainly for engineer career. And in the university, regarding kind of physics or chemistry or biology, kind of usual molecular science, there is nowhere someone focusing on home cooking. Nowhere. And the only people able to do that, indeed people engaged in molecular gastronomy, because molecular gastronomy is about home cooking and what happens in the kitchen when you cook. And this is not a serious subject. I mean, people don't think this is a serious subject, because this is just home cooking. And there is no money to do with that, it's not the industry, it's just something happening at home, and it's not a subject. And since this is not a subject, you cannot build your career on that. Which means we are maybe a few people in France focusing on this kind of stuff, let's say LATs, everyone, myself, maybe 4 or 5 people maximum in France doing what I explained to you, which means trying to understand what happened when you cook. And all these people, of course I know all of them, start with something else. Like myself, I start my career working on cancer and epigenetics. And I got a position on the CNRS because I work on epigenetics, which is serious. And once I went into the CNRS, then I could do anything I want as a side subject. But I would never have got a position if I started by studying home cooking and then, you know, going into this contest, because in France there's a contest like in a big kind of country if you want to. Get your permanent position, and if you go in this contest saying, oh, I'm fond of trying to understand the souffle or fromage, and what happens when you do your French fries, it's okay, no, there is more serious people around for this position. And so that's why you have to, you know, have kind of trick around, you know, have a serious subject, and then do what you want. So that's basically what happened. That's why today I can play the fool or make it my event. Because I also have some serious publication on cancer.
And just for, so that we know, is your work now being taken more seriously because you are doing this after doing epigenetics?
It's, but that's the trick. It's serious because people know, again, I've published some serious things. But you still today has to show that, look, I published a cell paper on DNA biophysics. Oh, so you're a good scientist, yeah. So that's why I'm listening to you talking about mayonnaise on social media. And but you have to have this kind of, you know, white stuff saying, look, I do some good things. And still today. So that's why I got many people, many students coming to my lab asking, oh, I want to do your job, I want to do cooking science. I said, okay, but first, I mean, come in 10 years, not now, just do something else, and then come back again and we can work together for cooking science. But don't do this now, because you will just, I mean, spoil your career. And still today, that's the way it is. I don't know how many times, yes, still today.
I would second all you say, especially in literature, which is, especially French literature, tends to be like detached from the material realities. But if you see the novels or the text, you can realize that authors knew that the material world exists, and so it deserves to be studied. But also, food is a multifaceted object. And so you need many disciplines to study it in the right way and to have some sort of complete picture of it. And this in itself is a difficulty in the academic field, because we tend to work to have a really good grasp about food, well, we need science, anthropology, psychology, literature, but we would need many more disciplines. So this is why maybe it's interesting to share what we have to say about it, because ultimately food touches all aspects of our lives, so we need all disciplines.
I just want to second what you just said, because we had actually had a conversation earlier about the fact that McMaster has no really no real food studies program, but we have lots of different people from all different departments and fields that are doing research on food. And wouldn't it be wonderful to bring us all together to have conversations about all of that? So, yeah. Exciting, and thank you for this panel too, because it's a nice
thing
to begin that project.
I will add to that. I think it's incredibly difficult to actually do interdisciplinary and multidisciplinary, and especially establish yourself in that. People often flourish very well in a small field, but the kind of work I echo my colleagues here that. I can't do the work in isolation. This is all relational. The food is relational. Mindfulness is relational. Humans are relational. So sitting in one lab, sitting in one building does not actually do justice to the experience of all this. So when I came to actually Mac as a postdoc many, many years back, things were very different. Means when I will tell them that I will actually do meditation. And there were people who were flippant enough to tell me, so why do you waste your time? And people were actually, they said that. Fast forward all these years, things have changed. People no longer say that. They still give you kind of that odd look, that you don't you have something else to do. But it's interesting, in fact, that, you know, science is an enterprise of human mind. Yet scientists who are engaged in that enterprise do not value the aspect of rest to optimize the mind. So this is actually very, very interesting and disheartening to me, that people who use intellect are not in favor of optimizing the intellect, because every single study from cognition to neurobiology to psychology will tell you that if you rest your mind, your mind functions better. It makes decision better, it perceives better, it do synthetic thinking better. But this is actually fascinating to me, that the scientists would not actually go that road. They would rather bury their head into the lab, sleepless, at the same time publishing about the sleep and the values.
Well, that's it for the show this week. I hope you enjoyed the question and answer period. Of course, I would like to thank our panelists for letting me use this audio. I would like to thank everybody from Researchers Night for having me and Helen as moderators. I had a really great time. And I think it may have inspired me to do a little bit more food science, so maybe look forward to that in the future, certainly on our YouTube channel, which I will link to in the show notes. Anyway, thank you. See you next week. Bye.
Whipped cream with sugar. Otherwise, just whipped cream.
So I don't have sugar, but I have your kind of sugar you have here. So we just add this maple syrup as a sugar. So I have to open the bottle like this. And then there is again some magic. Why some magic? Just because I just told you that fat is your enemy when you want to make mousse. But cream is 35% fat. So I will try to make a mousse with my enemy. That's why it can be quite tricky. But then there is something I have to do is really to work on the ice. And you know that if you don't work on the ice, that's where you fail. So what I will do, just gently twist, in order to be sure that this is cold enough. And normally at what point it will start to become thick and hopefully make a kind of foam. So just let's twist. Might take some time. But if you are confident in chemistry, you should be confident in your recipe. So I will explain what's happening here. So hopefully what will happen. There is nothing to do with counteractive here. Because again, there is a lot of counteractive in cream, because you have a lot of proteins that are called casein. But all the proteins are busy with the fact that they have to stabilize the fat. So they cannot stabilize air bubbles. So I have to find another way to stabilize air bubbles. And the only thing I can imagine is to force the fat to become solid. And if it becomes solid, then all the air trapped inside won't be able to escape. That's why you need to work in a very cold environment in order to be sure that your fats are becoming solid, and then you don't need any kind of molecule to stabilize. You just need the physics, which is a big difference between the egg white. Egg white is about chemistry, here is about physics. Because what I'm trying to do is just to solidify the cream, and once it's solid, then it gives you this chunky method. So I got my chantilly here, can show you. But it's quite, again, you see, cooking is quite easy. It's nice chantilly, okay? You'll be able, maybe want to try after. I will try. It's a chantilly with maple syrup.